In a moment, we're going to bring on historian Michael Tesserian, and he will share some of his latest discoveries of forbidden knowledge, including the year 2012, one of my favorite years, and the Irish origins of civilization as well. Lots to talk with Michael about, so get ready on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Tesserian is an expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He has made the deepest researches into Atlantis, the origins of evil, and into the Irish origins of civilization. Michael is the author of Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, and the producer and presenter of Origins and Oracles, a series exploring ancient mysteries and forbidden knowledge. Michael's book considers the consequences of extraterrestrial involvement and clarifies much of the disinformation concerning Atlantis, Lemuria, and the periods before that. Michael addresses the orchestrated chaos of modern times and reveals the true origins of the present political machinery, which seems to be bringing the world we live in to some tough times, as well as stating the problems. Michael furnishes us with the solutions to moral and social predicaments that have been beset of humankind of millennia. He is our guest on Coast to Coast. Hello, Michael. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi, George. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
That's good. Nice to be back.
You're coming in loud and clear, Mr.
Okay, glad to hear that.
Lots going on. You know, today I was looking at a story that was in the Chicago Tribune, which was part of a national story, a world story, that they have found a better look Japanese explorers of the Nazca Lines in Peru. And I don't know if you stumbled into that or not. So many people still believe, Michael, that those lines may have been made for or by extraterrestrials. And it just fascinates me.
Isn't it amazing? Look at this discovery that they've made, Graham Hancock, recently off the coast of Ceylon under the ocean, where the whole continent of ancient Lemuria, they're seeing underground roads and underground temples. We have the Great Pyramid that was discovered recently in Serbia. You know, so all over the world, these anomalies are starting to be uncovered. And the Nazca Lines, absolutely, those are definitely something that, you know, could only be seen from the air. So how do we explain that?
Well, you know, Michael, if we had to paint a picture of what this planet looked like 5 or 10,000 years ago, would it be dramatically different from the planet of today? Of course, we rule out the big buildings and things we have, but what do you think the planet looked like then?
Oh, I think it was incredibly different. We're talking, there's a big reason why, you know, people have tried, historians have tried to center civilization's origins about 7 to 11,000 years ago, because there's a desperate campaign to not have the human race just look back slightly before that, specifically around 13,500 years ago, when I believe there was an axial shift, if not an entire pole shift, then certainly a very significant shift. And that may have mean, that may mean many things geologically. That may mean that the oceans are recent arrivals to this planet. It may mean that whole continents were here that are not here, as Jim Allen and Graham Hancock and Michael Cremo and a lot of other scholars now from within academia are stating that this is, you know, more than likely. The people, you know, academics at the top of the totem pole now, my mind is specifically going to Allen and Dallaire from Oxford and Cambridge University, who have, you know, shattered these myths of Darwinism. We have Richard Milton. We have so many people from within the official establishment now at the top of the academic totem pole within the subjects of geology and anthropology, confirming that something awesome, cataclysms of unimaginable proportions, happened on this planet in very recent times, George.
And I also think, Michael, that the inhabitants of this planet lots of years ago, thousands of years ago, had some pretty high technology, technology that we might not even have today.
Well, you couldn't be more correct. And, you know, I go into this in my work as well, that as Zachariah Sitchin has shown in his Sumerian revelations, as scholars before him even knew from the Mahabharata and the Vedas of India, I have discovered in the Norse Edda of the Scandinavian people, and also in the Celtic records of my own country, that this reference, the references to super technologies, not just to mental abilities, you know, very powerful mental abilities, but absolutely to super weaponry, the likes of which may not have been understood by our ancestors, because, of course, they didn't have the technology that the ancients had. We are now building cryogenic chambers. We have cybernetics again, and we have, you know, these weapons of mass destruction. We're creating them again. We have all sorts of harp radiation. And now we can reread the ancient myths and realize, my goodness, so did they. The references are right there of these terrible weapons of ancient power and spacecrafts and flying ships and wars of the gods. It's in the ancient records.
You have talked about fallen angels, but you bring a different twist to it, Michael, a twist that I have not heard from anybody. Let's get a little bit of your description.
Well, you see, this subject has always fascinated me, the whole concept of Atlantis, Lemuria, the idea that there was alien involvement on the planet Earth, and that there may have been a visitation of what the Bible and the ancient texts talk about as the fallen angels. My work, though, differs because I am not of the persuasion that I'm more in the, you know, I am more in the line of the author William Bramley. He and I share a lot in common in the sense that we do not think that these involvements, and of course there's been many involvements of extraterrestrial beings on our planet, but the group that you're speaking of, that you've just mentioned, the Nephilim, the fallen angels, the Anunnaki, in my reading of it, they're not some benevolent big brother to humanity who's come here to set everything aright. In my reading of it, these are people who interfered with the biology of the human being, and that the concept of evil, the concept of injustice and sadism and belligerence and the whole bloodlust that is in the human being actually has a date of birth, and that these proclivities of human beings date from the time of this intervention and in the transgenic experiments, which made a mess of the human being's psychic, moral, and biological makeup.
So you're saying that this bad seed that is in the human spirit, the humankind, was put in there accidentally or intentionally?
No, very deliberately. Very, very deliberately. The ancient texts like the Popol Vuh and all of these, annals of Ireland are talking about the belligerence of the gods, the fact that, you know, it's like John Milton's Paradise Lost, where, in the words of Satan, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. These individuals wanted slaves. This is not my concoction. This is what the ancient legends are saying, that man was made, the Adamic man and the Eve were created necessarily to be a slave race, to serve the gods. So-called gods, you know, because remember, there's a big difference. I mean, there's a big difference when we talk to tribal ancestors and we read their ancient legends. It's remarkable that when they talk about the creator, we imagine that they're talking about God, and they're not. The term creator has been mistaken for the term God, but they're actually two different words. The ancients knew God, all right. They knew about the spirit, the Holy Spirit, the higher, sure, the higher spirit. But so when they're talking about creator, and that word has been mistranslated, so what I'm going to say has not been known. But they were talking about the creator of man as separate from the spiritual, you know, component of the universe. And this also needs to be brought out, that the idea of the creator of man is a mechanic, an architect, a sort of a genetic scientist type of race who had the sophistication sort of similar to what we are understanding now. And either through some sort of bizarre cloning experiment or transgenic experimentation, and perhaps even the junk DNA. And I'm convinced, I am absolutely convinced, and people can mark my words on this, that within the next 10 years, we are going to have revelations about genetics and DNA, which is going to support the contentions of people like myself. I'm not the first to have mentioned this, but I am very fervently in belief that very soon all of us are going to discover things about the DNA, perhaps even about the so-called junk DNA, that confirms the picture of the past that has been, you know, encoded into the great myths and legends of the world.
Now, explain that a little bit more, Michael. You're saying that science may find something,
yes,
that may give them or answer questions about what happened and how we were manipulated?
Yes, I do believe that very, very much so. I think they already have, if you really want my opinion, because, you know, things like molybdenum, which is a very rare metal, it's a trace element, and it's in the physiology of all Earth creatures, and yet this is a very molybdenum-poor planet. You know, there are so many anomalies that we can point to, the brain capacity of the Neanderthal, the transition to the Cro-Magnon, the rapid, like Lawrence Gardner and others have speculated, why is the incredible rapid development, especially technologically, of man in a short period of time when for millions of years he appeared to be in primitive, you know, this acceleration. So I think that the knowledge is already there. The information is already there. Scientists are very involved in this. People from MIT, CIT, they're looking into the behavior of man and seeing that he is not the same as the hominids. There's something remarkable. He stands out like a sore thumb. And we are now going to have to explain this and look at, and, you know, have a reappraisal of what man is, and perhaps that there was some sort of interference into the natural organic nature of man. And that, and I believe that this connects very strongly, as we've talked before on previous shows, about the philosophical question of evil, and that we need to address that this is not just something organic and natural to human beings. It has a date of birth.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately. And, you know, but the good thing about it, in a way, is that once you have properly and correctly diagnosed the problem, then you are halfway to the solution. The idea may be fugitive and controversial, but if we at least have the right diagnosis of the problem, we're halfway or more than halfway to the solution, and that's key.
Michael, you know, back to the fallen angels for a moment. Then I want you to kind of tie in the Irish origins of this, because interesting theories there as well. You believe that these fallen angels created Atlantis, don't you?
Yes, and not created Atlantis, but moved to—well, actually, no, you're right. On the continent of Appalachia, which is one of these great sunken continents of old, it's almost like if you imagine America, and then you have the, you know, the capital city, Washington, D.C., or you think of London, and you think of England, and you have London.
Sure.
There was a continent of Appalachia, and then upon that was the city-state, the city-citadel that we are calling Atlantis. Atlantis was not the continent. It was the city of the city-state, the citadel of power, where this hideous type of Planet of the Apes type of experiment took place. It's very
It's like the island of Dr. Moreau, huh?
You better. Good point. There's been so much. See, it's strange, isn't it, that it's in fiction. Maybe fortunately, unfortunately, who knows what. It's been in fiction and science fiction and fantasy and in folk tales that this great story has been preserved. It's only now we have to make one change, and that is that the science world has to come on board. I believe that can happen. I believe it already is happening, because our forefathers knew all about it and wrote it down in the minstrel tradition, especially in Ireland. The Gaelic legends are full of it. And so in exactly the same way as Zachariah Sitchin is talking about in the Sumerian records, in the Celtic Irish record, in the Arthurian tradition, it's all there. It's always been there. It's in the Maya shamans. It's in the North American Indians talk about it. All the annals and scriptures of the world, including the Bible, including the apocryphal works of Christianity, they're all there, this information. The only new slant is that science now needs to confirm the fact. And that might mean, yes, a radical, you know, shift in what we know about ourselves and our origins. But, George, this is the century for it. This, we're on a countdown here to, you know, 2012. In the next few years, this is the era for man to have the facts about his own origins and destiny.
Where does Lucifer fit into this theory, Michael?
Wow, that's a huge, huge question.
We got to roll him out somehow.
Well, obviously, Luciferianism ties into my, you know, if you want my opinion of it, this concept deals with a brotherhood. The brotherhood of the snake is what William Bramley calls it. It's the old dragon courts of old that originally, it's not a Christian term. And it's not even particularly a negative term. It just refers to those who are worshippers of light and worshippers of a certain kind of light, because there's many kinds of light. All religious doctrines talk about the light when they're trying to speak about divinity. The secret societies use symbolism that involves the sun and the light. But what we have to understand, because we're not members of secret societies, and therefore it can confuse us when we see this imagery and we might not interpret it correctly, there are many kinds of light, just as like there's many kinds of emotion. There's many kinds of love and many kinds of hate. And therefore, in this world, there are many kinds of light. There's a positive kind of light and there's a destructive kind of light. So in my work, I talk about what is called the dark side of the sun, or the dark side of light. As we know, the stronger a light shines, then there's also a darker shadow. So there's a certain property, metaphysically and physically, by the way. And as light casts the shadow physically, try to interpret that metaphysically. What does metaphysical light cast? It also casts ignorance. And there are people in this world who benefit from this kind of ignorance that is cast by light. For instance, imagine that I'm holding up a light, a very bright halogen light. There's a couple, and I'm shining it in your eyes. There's a couple of things that have just happened. I am blinding you, so you can't see. So you're in a state of blindness.
Right.
Yes. And also, I am concealed from you, and you can't see me. So it's very important for people to realize the weapon of light, that light can be used as a weapon. It's extremely important that the human race start to understand this, because commercials, advertisements, the culture of light in our society is not being used very spiritually. And to answer your question, it is the non-spiritual use of light, or the subversive use of light, that is Luciferianism, in a nutshell. I also refer to it as Atonism, based on the old god of Akhenaten, Aton, the Egyptian god where they mistakenly thought that that was the first form of monotheism, which it is not. So if you're blinded, that's why do you think the Illuminati call themselves Illuminati? Why do they use the symbol of the light? Because they're using the darker side of the light, the darker properties of light. But if you're not closely looking at it, you can imagine that it's the same kind of light that Christianity are talking about when they speak of Jesus and they speak of God. But I'm here to tell you it is not the same. You must see beneath the veil, read between the lines, and realize that this kind of light is being used as a weapon to blind the human race, to keep them ignorant, and to conceal the people who may be wielding that light upon you. That is the reason why light is so important to the Albert Pikes, to the Freemasons, to the Giuseppe Mazzinis, and the Weishaupts, and the whole cabal of those who understand this property of light and who have gained complete subservience of the human race by using this weapon upon us. So we need to learn about the occult properties of these kinds of things, and that is the study of, you know, the Christians are right to call it Luciferianism. It's a good term. It works. It relates to the sun and the worship of the sun. But it also worships the dark side of the sun, which Christians perhaps are not too aware of, and they need to be aware of it, because there's properties being used against the human race that have nothing to do with anything sacred at all.
Well, these fallen angels, were they extraterrestrials from the physical realm?
Yeah.
Or were they from some other dimensional realm?
As far as I can make out, and remember, I'm just referring to the ancient legends, they were physical. They were humanoid beings. The only thing is that they were more advanced than us scientifically. As a matter of fact, they may have even been more backward than us emotionally and spiritually. So we are in ascendancy. The humanoid that was here, the ancestors, we can look at it like the original humanoid was actually more advanced, and we still are. We are feared. The human race is feared by the masters who control this planet because they have technological skill and great scientific ability,
right.
but they have no spiritual or moral development or any kind of maturity that way.
I think our free will baffled them too, Michael.
Free will is a key thing, and they want to make sure that we have the illusion of free will even when we don't. Remember, these individuals are like a massive corporation, and freedom is not something that's, you know, of interest to them. They don't mind you thinking that you have the illusion of freedom, but the actual thing, it's like Jordan Maxwell has spoken many times about the difference between relative liberty and true existential freedom. There's a big difference in the world between liberty, which is, you know, your slave master giving you a bowl of soup, and of course nowadays they're giving you half a bowl of soup and making you like it, and the difference between really opening the prison gates and letting you go. And there's all difference in the world between those two realities.
Does past scripture, writings, texts, anything allude to where they came from?
Well, of course, we have the normal New Age theories. Some people saying Sirius, some people saying Orion. What I look to is what has been discovered by the Egyptologists in the design of the make of the pyramid. The pyramids of Egypt seem to be aligned to Alpha Draconis. And therefore, though I'm not convinced, but I think that Alpha Draconis, that star in the constellation of Draco, is probably a very good bet. And as you know, as we all know, those who've been really studying the subject know the symbol of the dragon and the symbol of the serpent is not only found on the royal dynasties of the world, it is one of the most prevalent symbols in the world. This very brotherhood we're talking about refers to themselves as the Serpent Brotherhood. So the serpent, or Draco, the dragon, Alpha Draconis, there's some tie in there to the idea of the serpent, even as the Chinese use the famous dance of the serpent. It's a very ancient motif. We know that the serpent image turns up in countries where there was no physical snakes. Then how can you have those carvings on their walls? Very unusual imagery connecting to the serpent and the Serpent Brotherhood. So there's no doubt in my mind that they're using this for a reason. And the star that would tie into is the constellation of Draco and Alpha Draconis. So right now, that's my bet.
Interesting. The serpent itself, did they resemble this creature?
No. And this is another area of disinformation that definitely needs to be cleared up. I'm glad that you asked me that. There are reptilian beings in the world. I have no doubt about that. I totally concur with David Icke and with John Rhodes and others who are looking into this. However, the missing piece is that these creatures that we're referring to as reptoid or reptilian do not themselves originate from outer space. These individuals, in my reading of the work, were actually a creation here. They were made in exactly the same way as the atoms that we spoke of earlier were made, except that their DNA was not humanoid at all. It was alien DNA crossed with animal DNA, and these are the reptilian beings. They're not from off-world, they're from here.
And why is the origins of Irish people so important? We'll be talking with... Well, hold on, Michael. We'll get that from you when we come back. And our special guest tonight, Michael Tesarian. So get ready. We'll be back with Michael as we continue chatting. We're going to bring in the Irish origins of civilization. Michael says it's very important. We'll find out why on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Michael, why is the Irish origins of civilization so important?
Well, George, obviously, that's a huge question. And that's what, you know, my work is hoping to bring in. It's a missing piece that connects with all of the other subject matter that we are interested in this world. It ties in with the idea that we do have to look back to ancient origins in order to discover what is going on in our world today and why certain symbols are used by the royal families and the secret societies and the elites. And we have to get around the idea that, yes, Egyptian culture has been looked at as being one of the most ancient, but we have to get around a very simple idea, and that is that Irish culture is the oldest in Europe. It predates Egyptian culture. So it's healthy and it's excellent that the human race is aware, finally getting a little bit more aware, of the power of Egypt, because Egypt was in a tremendous ancient culture and all eyes are fixed on the marvels of Egypt and the idioms and customs of those dynasties. But what we also need to be doing at the same time is realizing, recapturing, re-understanding the Irish connections. Now, this always comes as a massive shock to people, of course, because most people are not aware of the antiquity of Ireland, and they're not aware of the connections that Ireland has to these eastern lands, particularly Egypt. So my work is about Ireland, but it is also about Egypt, because what we have to understand is that after the fall of the continents of Lemuria and Atlantis that we were just speaking about together, that when, you know, these continents are obviously not here anymore. So what happened? They were destroyed in the great cataclysms that all our native peoples and ancient legends talk about. But the survivors, whatever survivors there were, they colonized Britain. This is where the legends are. And you know, you've heard of the luck of the Irish, and we've heard that Ireland is known as the Blessed or the Fortunate Isles. There's a reason for that. It's because it was known in antiquity that these were indeed the Blessed Isles, because they survived those massive cataclysms of old. So my work in the beginning with the original book, Atlantis, was to sketch in the background, but I am, as I've always said, I'm interested in history, but I'm more interested in what we're, you know, the way we're living now and the problems that beset the human race now. So it's important to sketch in the background, but then, okay, the continents of old sink. Then what? You know, you can't just leave it half-baked. We got to say, hey, there were survivors. Then what happened to the survivors? What kind of civilizations did they create? Let's get into that. Now, in the Atlantis book, I didn't want to make it too top-heavy with that. The Atlantis subject that I went into with the origins of evil and the genetic manipulation of mankind and the suppression of woman, all of these different topics, man, that's controversial enough, you know, so I had to draw the line somewhere. So the Irish origins of civilization, really, George, is a pickup from that point on. I had to deal with the subject of post Atlantean culture. I had to do it separately. There was no way to, you know, continue the same book. It would have just been too much. So the Irish origins of civilization is actually about the same subject. It's just a pickup from the time of the survivors, with the idea that it was in the western lands of Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales, which was used to be called Briton, B-R-I-T-O-N, the Britons, sure, or the Celts. And it is from there that the high cultures, the high civilizations moved eastward. So the controversial thing about the new book, probably the most controversial thing about it, is that it refutes the idea that the elements of civilization moved, as we have always been told in school and from official sources, from east to west. I'm not saying that migrations of importance didn't happen, but what I am saying is that the east to west movement of civilization is a much later phenomenon, and historians are pointing to that as if to try and tell us wrongly that the elements of civilization moved from eastern lands to the west. This is not the case. It is the same lie, the same historical fallacy, as the one that they tried to give us where history itself just starts 7 to 11,000 years ago. Now, that has been shot to pieces. New discoveries are being made about the cultural advancement of the ancients. We're learning all of this. So my work is to say, well, then let's keep on doing it. Let's go a step forward and realize that we also have to put to bed this whole idea of the elements of civilization, the symbols, the customs of civilization, moving from the east to the west. If you do that, if you reverse the mirror and turn it round, your picture of the world that you're living in, the picture of history that you've been taught, is going to radically change for the better. You're going to be able to answer why it is that Celtic, Nordic-type people are found in China. You're going to be able to answer the question, you see, of the navigation of the high seas in the ancient world. You're going to understand why the Maya, for instance, talk about the fact that the gods who visited them were tall, blonde, and blue-eyed. You're going to be able to explain the Anasazi ruins in America. You're going to be able to explain the discoveries of Barry Fell, the great suppressed American scholar who found the Ogham alphabet, the old Druidic alphabet here in America hundreds of years before Columbus got here. You know, you're going to understand the great discoveries of Glenn Kimball, the archaeologist who's working on the Ohio Mound here, that big serpent mound here.
Sure. Where they're digging. By the way, he's going to be on next week at a special roundtable discussion. He's very good at what he does, Michael.
Well, I want to spend then this moment to say that people should listen to what Glenn is talking about. For goodness sake, listen to what this man, he sent me photographs when they opened these tombs, and he said, Michael, can you confirm for me that these are Celtic? Because we're looking at something here, and to me it looks like Celtic. And I conferred, I said, exactly, this is the whole point, that these artifacts that you're bringing out are of Nordic and Celtic design. Now, I am not the first person to speak about this. This story of the East to West, of the West to East movement of civilization was brought up in this country by Ignatius Donnelly, who is a good friend of your President Lincoln here, in the early part of the colonization of America. You have Connor McDowry. You see, you have Augustus Leplongeon, the great scholar. You have Glenn Kimball more recently. You see, this is something that has not truly been grasped. We need to throw back the veil on this incredible story and find out that civilization, the elements, moved from the West to the Eastern lands. And then later, in A.D., starting at 6th century B.C., up until 10th century A.D. at the William the Conqueror, yes, we did have migrations from the West back, and we know why we had those now, because the Middle East, the Levant, especially in Palestine, was visited by the most horrendous droughts, and there was also a massive upheaval, oppressive upheaval, during the time of Akhenaton, where mass exoduses were taking place from the East. And so the cultures of, the elements of culture, the symbol, the regalia, the heraldry, that we find, you know, proficiently, you know, so profusely disseminated through the Western lands, started to come back. But the operative word is that it was coming back. It was not coming for the first time. There was much more ancient Druidic colleges in the before time. And this explains the work of J.R.R. Tolkien, and many of the fictional books, again, have been speaking about this. But we now need to look at this because it's an essential part of the revelations concerning our planet and our world and our history.
Who colonized Ireland, or was it Ireland that colonized all these other places?
Basically, is what you did, the latter part. It's that I would say that the one thing is that the ancient Irish, this is the earliest inhabitants of Ireland, the early proto people of Ireland, who were called the Gaels, G-A-E-L-S, they spoke that they came from destroyed lands, but they spoke of four lands, not one. So this is disinformation that I clear up, is that there was more than one continent in the ancient times that was destroyed. The Gaels say that they arrived on Ireland, and it's interesting, isn't it, that the leader of the Gaels was a man called Nada, that's how you pronounce it in Gaelic, but in English you pronounce it Noah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And this Noah came, and get this, George, he came in a boat. He came in a ship in which he had saved his people, and the ship arrived at the coast of Ireland, and he was the savior of his people. Check
now, wouldn't that be fascinating if that's what happened?
It's just one of these post-Diluvian ancient mythological stories that is worldwide, can be found worldwide. And these individuals talk about the four lost islands, and I believe it is these high Gaelic cultures. That then, because remember, the word Celtic is not used by the ancient Irish. That was a Greek term. The Romans and the Greeks gave the word Celt to the Celts. So there's other terms that we need to be familiar with, and one of them is the Gaels. The Gaelic race were a powerful Druidic culture, very, very much endowed with spiritual and moral and technological abilities from the ancient civilizations which have been destroyed. So a lot of people have studied the ancient civilizations, but they're leaving off, George. They're stopping at, you know, a certain moment in time, and then they're not picking up the story to say, okay, well then, what are we doing? How did our civilizations get created? There's a tremendous missing piece here. It's like having a painting in which you've got the far ground and you've got the foreground, but you've no middle ground. We've got
Somewhere along the line, there was this incredible myth and legend in Ireland of leprechauns. Fascinates me because, you know, when they talk about these little people with these, you know, incredible mystical powers, Something was happening during that time period. What do you think it was?
Well, isn't it also interesting that when you do hear the terms in mythology about the folk, leprechauns and the elves and the fairies and the goblins and all of it, and the dwarves, when we all hear about that, what else are we also hearing about? We're invariably hearing about Hollow Earth, because all of these beings are meant to be interred in the earth, or they live beneath the earth. So the interesting thing is that Irish mythology also talks not only about these strange kinds of beings, but it also talks about the Hollow Earth concept, another fascinating idea that, you know, like the Scandinavians have their king under the mountain.
Yes.
And this is a tremendous study of the hollow place, the holy place, the original holy places where the oracles and the gods lived in the Hollow Earth. And Irish culture is, as you say, filled with these ideas. A lot of it is some of it's mistranslation from later monks and later people who looked back and misinterpreted the stories, because the word fairy in ancient Celtic did not mean what it means today. It actually meant a being of power, a person who could shift their form and live in, and adopt different bodies, modalities of living. So there's a whole, elf comes from the Scandinavian alva, which just means the white one or the pure one or the empowered one. And we have the banshee. And do you know the word in Celtic for power is exactly the same word in Hindi, siddhi. The word for magical power is sid, S-I-D-E or S-I-D-H-E.
Well, but do you believe these were real beings?
Oh, yeah. I believe that these beings... Remember, we're looking back, so there's a lot of misinterpretation and there's a lot of coloring. But in the ancient times, the original Sid, or the original She, they call it, it's actually pronounced She in Gaelic, S-H-E. The original Gaelic people were people of unbelievable power, both technologically and magically. There's no question in my mind about that. These records are to be taken as seriously as a scientist would take his own theorems and paradigms. We have to start taking the legends of our forefathers in exactly that same reverent way. You know, I mean, the idea how I got interested in this is because, do you know that they say that everyone's heard of Nefertiti, right? The famous Egyptian queen?
Yeah, absolutely.
How many people know that her daughter is buried in Ireland?
Her daughter is buried in Ireland? How'd she get there?
That's right. The story of Scotia, the daughter of Pharaoh Akhenaten and Nefertiti, was actually called Meretaten, but she was also called the nickname Scota, S-C-O-T-A. She's a woman who gives her name to Scotland. So, you know, we grew up in Ireland, and when I investigated this in Ireland, we discover that not only is Scotia, the daughter of the pharaohs of Egypt, buried and traveled to live, to die, and to be buried in Ireland, this microscopic country on the western seaboard. We find out that in Christian occult legends, the Christian scholars point out that the prophet Jeremiah is buried in Ireland. They even know that his grave is in Loch Crew. We have a Tia Tefi, an Egyptian princess, buried in Ireland. We have mummified baboons. And check this out. The first king of the first dynasty of Egypt, this is millennia ago, the first king of the first dynasty was a king called Menes, M-E-N-E-S. He's buried in Northern Ireland.
What were they doing there?
Right. This is betraying the fact of the intense and deep rapport connections in ancient times between Ireland and England. These individuals were returning home. The Egyptian culture, I am believing, and I'm going, you know, my book is about this, is that I believe that the Egyptian pharaonic theocracies, even the autocracy, the setup, the whole monarchistic setup, a lot of the idioms that they used,
right,
and certainly, and most importantly, the theology, because earlier we talked about Luciferianism and the cult of the sun. I'm believing that the original solar church, the original stellar church, was Irish, and that it was the foundation of the Egyptian paradigm, that what we're calling Egypt is actually based on Irish Druidism. This has been purported. When I came to Ireland, I was studying this and, of course, you know, was of the opinion that nobody was interested in this. And then I bump into Jordan Maxwell, who publicly says from the stage, "Do you not know that all Judeo-Christianity is based on Druidism?" So, you know, my heart nearly, you know, came out of my mouth. I said, what? American scholar saying this? He's absolutely right. So this has been a slow work to try and show that the roots of Egyptian and even Christian culture go back to the old Irish culture, the old Irish solar church that we need to start discovering about. And this explains why it is that so many of these dignitaries, for instance, Jeremiah in Ireland was not called Jeremiah. He was actually given the name Olam Fala, right? Olam is the old word for druid. And it's where we get the word oligarchy. So when people are saying, you know, the oligarchy, O-L-I or O-L-L-A, Ola meant the wise ones, the high ones. We still get our word oligarchy from that. And that was one of the names of Jeremiah.
Are there any pyramids in Ireland, by
any
chance?
Yeah, and they were taken down. In a great book by a fellow scholar, I think you're going to have him on your show very soon, is Andrew Power. He wrote a book called Ireland, Land of the Pharaohs. He's a fellow Irishman from Northern Ireland. He claims that at the... do you know that the oldest burial mound or oldest temple in the world is in Ireland?
I did not know that.
Yeah, it predates the pyramid by thousands of years, and it's in a place called County Meath. And it's the actual location is Newgrange, and it's been visited by your great scientists like Arthur C. Clarke and others, and lots of tourists go there every year. I certainly recommend people to go and look at this amazing building. There's pictures of it on my website. Now, around that particular tumulus, which is just a name for a holy shrine, there were, according to Andrew Power, pyramidal buildings that were taken down, and that these pyramidal style buildings had to go because it was absolutely important for the control hierarchy to not let Ireland's significance. Because not only is Ireland the oldest civilization in the world, it has been the most raped and the most brutalized of all civilizations. There has been a campaign of genocide and destruction that is hard to fathom. Even
why?
And that's saying, well, because it's very important that the Irish culture, just through the British government and through the power elites, starting from Rome, starting from the time of Julius Caesar, there was a campaign to wipe out the Druids to a man because, you know, you can't have a slave race, can you, George, if everyone's realizing that they have a spiritual destiny in the world to live up to. That had to be suppressed. Yeah, that had to be suppressed. So we were given this idea that the Druids were just a bunch of sacrificing tree worshippers, a bunch of maniacs running around there in Anglesey and you know, in England and worshipping, you know, trees. All lies. This was the enlighteners of the world. These were people who had colleges all over the world. The Grecian colleges of Pythagoras and Benares in India, all were stemmed from the Celtic influence. We know this because the Sanskrit language is the closest in the world is to Gaelic. And here's the interesting thing also, is that the scholars do not say that Gaelic came from Sanskrit. They leave it hanging. Well, the obvious interpretation is that the parent language must have been then Gaelic. They won't say it, but it's absolutely true to those who've done their homework.
How come history doesn't say this stuff?
Oh, it does. It does. It just it's just that...
I never got this in school.
No, because the original scholars who I'm following in the footsteps of are three people, and most of them are turn of the century. At the turn of the century, there was a lady called Anna Wilkes. Then there was the famous American scholar Connor McGarry. Americans, you know, again, you're not familiar with too many of your great scholars.
No, we aren't. I'm not.
It hurts me to know that because many of the people that have revealed these things, like Ignatius Donnelly, Charles Berlitz, you know, there's so many scholars in this country who have already written on this subject. It's just that their works were suppressed. So Connor McGarry was the one who exposed this. And then in 1960 in England, there was a man called Commons Beaumont. People who've, you know, looked at my work and my DVDs know I refer to him a lot. Commons Beaumont picked up the story, but immediately was dropped. After he passed on, then the story lapsed again. And I think I'm one of the first people to pick it up since the time of Commons Beaumont. And being Irish is a part of it, you know, because I had to answer these idioms for myself and see these tremendous connections in the ancient stories of why it is that in ancient Egyptian books there's mention of Ireland. And you have these mummified baboons in Ireland. There's a whole connection here. The, you know, Meretaten, which is Nefertiti's daughter, being actually buried. The people can go to County Kerry and actually go to the tomb. I mean, it's that obvious. So the work is there. It's just that it needs to be put into proper context. It needs to be brought out of the shadows. And people need to see the story because those who are interested in history and knowing why these incredible power symbols, why they exist in our world.
Well, pull out your information on 2012, Michael, because we'll talk about that at the top of the hour, all right? Michael Tesarian, our guest, his websites, he's got many of them. They're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Well, less than six years away, and we go into 2012. And, of course, the big date, December 21st, 2012, that's the key date. That's the one we're all interested in. What is going to happen? Let's get Michael Tesarian's take on all of this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, our guest, Michael Tesarian. Michael, one of the great benefits of Coast to Coast is we can talk with a lot of different... What is that beep, Michael?
Did you hear something?
Yes, I heard a horrible beep. Oh, okay. All right. Well, you know, one of the benefits of Coast to Coast is we talk with a lot of people about a lot of different things, and they have different views. Yours, of course, on 2012 and the Mayan calendar is an interesting perspective all to itself. Explain a little bit, though, about the Maya, if you can, what you know of them, why they came to do what they did, and then what happened to them.
Well, the Maya were a group of shaman. We're talking about a race that has, again, been misunderstood. It's been recently found out that their ancestry may go back at least 50,000 years before the official dates that have been given. They were obviously a shaman class, very closely connected to the Druids, I think. There's a element there, a tie-in. But what we do know about them is that they were obsessed with time. They were obsessed with the idea of the movement of the planets, and with time, and more than that, they were interested in prophecy. They didn't just have one calendar that was important. They had about 22 of very accurate calendars. Of the two, the most famous ones are called the Dzogchen calendar, which is the one that's most studied. You know, it's the big round one, which has the face in the middle,
right,
and the beautiful hieroglyphics. That's actually called the Dzogchen calendar. But they had the Hunab, and they had some other ones. It just turns out that the prophecy that is causing so much controversy is connected to the Dzogchen, and is connected to the idea that they had 13 different ages. We know that all ancient peoples had creation myths in which they say that there are cycles. This is the fascinating part, is that the Native American Indians, the Zuni, the Hopi, and the Maya, just like many European ancient aboriginal groups, all believe that creation opens, comes to its peak, and then passes away. That there are, just in the same way that, say, the year is a sort of a cycle that has four seasons, and that there is a winter cycle, you know, and a creation cycle, spring, so further up the fractal, numerically speaking, there are also these phases, these phase shifts, and these rhythms and cycles. And they were obsessed by this. And, of course, many of their predictions actually came right. The idea that Cortez, you know, would come and destroy their civilization. All of these things actually happened to pretty much to the day that the Maya had made their predictions. And they talk about the 13 great cycles. They talk about the four great creation myths of fire, water, air, and earth. And they talk about the 13 phases of this particular age. And they said that the 13, in 1999, somewhere between 96 and 99, the 13th age would begin, and that would run for 13 years until 2012. And when we pass by 96 and pass by into 99, the human race would be in what they refer to as an age of revealing. And this is their own words, the age of revealing or the age of revelation, and it's very, very similar to what the Bible talks about as the age of apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this has, you know, been gaining a lot of attention. Now, the interesting thing is...
that's because we're getting pretty darn close now, Michael.
That's what I was just going to say. You know, I focus a lot on this year, because at the end of this year, in November to be specific, there's an amazingly important moment in which the planet Pluto, which is the planet of revelation, the planet that reveals what is hidden in astrological terminology or in astrological jargon, is Pluto.
Now, what do you mean by that? Because Pluto wasn't even known at that time.
It doesn't matter. We're talking, when you're talking about archetypes, it doesn't matter what stereotype a particular culture or idiom will use. The idea, or the archetypal idea, that there is something hidden that will be revealed is known in every iconography. All that changes is the iconography or the motif. So yeah, nowadays we're projecting the meaning onto a planet that has now been discovered. But the concept that we're talking about was known in ancient times and was assigned to different gods. Maybe it was Mars in the past, you see, or it was, Tezcatlipoca. In every age, you have a different agent that represents the coming. In India, for instance, you have the god Shiva. In Christian mythology, you have the idea of the reaper, you know, and the apocalypse. So there's all sorts of, or a different aspect of Christ, where he comes in with a sword and so on. So the idioms may change, the explanations may change, but the concept of it is an eternal thing that is an archetype. In the modern parlance, we understand that this planet in the zodiac, Pluto, is about revelation. Now, it's interesting because astrologically, the planet Pluto crosses galactic center in November of this year and continues to be affecting the planet very strongly all through the year 2007. 2007 is the exact midway point between the opening of the 13-year cycle to the end of 2012.
And the opening was 1999, right?
99, exactly. Okay. So the halfway point is 2007, and the 0 year of the Maya is about 2012, December 21st, because at that point, the sun will do the same thing. On the morning of December 21st, 2012, the sun will be crossing galactic center. And the most important thing, I think, is to realize is that what galactic center is. Galactic center has always been referred to as the sun behind the sun, the center of the universe, the place from which all energy is coming. At least this was the occult idea. This was the idea that obsessed those who were into ritual, you see, and from the shamanistic tradition and from the astrological tradition. And when a planet moves in front of that location, it's almost as if a filter is put in front of a camera, or a colored light is put in front, a colored filter is put in front of a, you know, strong light. So it's sort of the color is different. The energy shifts. And when Pluto's energy, like a lens in front of a camera or in front of a strong light, moves in front of galactic center, in short, what it means is that there's a new type of light, a different kind of light shining to show up a different kind of dirt. It's almost like when the sunlight is coming in through your window and suddenly you see all the dust and particles that are in the air that you wouldn't have normally seen.
Right.
That's kind of what I mean psychologically.
Yeah, I look at those, Michael, and say, I'm breathing those things.
I know it. Well, the metaphor is that that's what people are going to be thinking and attitudinally tuning into in the countdown periods, have been already, and will amp up very significantly as 2007 begins. It's not a bad thing. It's a healthy thing. It's just time for it. Time wasn't before for this. Time is now. There's nothing to be afraid of when you hear terms like Asia revealing and apocalypse. It's a perfectly natural observation, which the human being is quite capable of doing. We've done it before, and it now needs to do it. In simple psychological terminology, what it refers to is merely looking at the dark side of the psyche. It means that there will be more revelations socially about kind of, you know, people, what they are behind the mask. There may be more revelations regarding corporations and individuals and showing that they're not quite the people that they appear to be and what have you. But see, again, that's a very healthy thing.
But how did the Mayans know that?
Prediction. The art of prophecy is fascinating. You've had so many guests on who have talked about this.
Sure.
The cult of prophecy from Edgar Cayce. And, you know, we're just talking about the Irish origins of civilization. My goodness, did you know that the things that we're talking about now go back 5,000 years ago? There was prophecies from ancient Irish prophets.
Of course. Yeah. All kinds of prophets.
All
from
kinds
everywhere.
Of prophecy. So it's usually through a combination of intuition, imagination, but also scientific fact that there are cycles. Vico, Plato, they all have talked about the rise and fall of these civilizations, and they obey certain tendencies. Now, the actual mechanics of it, of how one can predict what's coming, is most extraordinarily interesting. And it actually has to do with a very simple phenomenon. And that phenomenon can be best stated, or was best stated, by the Greeks when they said that character is fate. So, and this is what my work belabors enormously, and that is that you can predict what's going to happen outside by predicting the psychological temperament of people, both individually and collective, because it is the schizoid person that creates a schizogenic society. It is the pathological mind that creates a pathological society. So when you when you're able to psychologically see, and this is what Pluto helps to do, you see, Pluto is coming in to say, okay, folks, we're going to tune you up now so that you will gain the psychological ability to be able to see life in a more of a psychological way, because you need that kind of insight, because all the other explanations that you have for explaining the world around you are not working anymore. There's a phase shift. The phase shift basically started even during the new millennium. The new millennium, I've always said, is an age of solutions. It might be a major shock for a lot of people, but, you know, that's as may be. The most important thing is there's going to be new paradigms of seeing, new awarenesses within consciousness. I just use astrological jargon to make myself explain. But what my real interest is the psychological upgrading of our intelligence so that we start to use different sensual and different mental and intellectual abilities to see the phenomena of the world and the phenomena of mankind in a different way than maybe we've been trained to do so before.
All right, but no question, during the 2012 period, the Mayans had predicted some kind of major astrological event.
Yeah, they don't really even say what will come afterwards. They just talk about the ending of this cycle and that there's a different way of life. People interpret that in all sorts of ways. I tend to interpret it merely like this, that the kind of life that we've been used to will pass away. Nature is not going to pass away. That's man's ego to think that he can affect, you know, the natural order. He cannot.
Sure.
So definitely, maybe the kind of lifestyle that we're living sociologically. You know what they really say is that relationships and domestic situations will change dramatically. It's sort of like in the Western system when they talk about the coming of the age of Aquarius. You know, we're ending the age of Pisces and moving into the age of Aquarius. And again, even those individuals are saying that it's, sure, governmental, militaristic, social, civic things will change. You know, that could be for good or for bad. It could hearken in the New World Order situation. We definitely have to look into that. But don't forget that this also affects the most intimate relationships around people. It's going to happen very close to home originally. So my particular message is to, you know, to look to that as well, because I don't want those people who've been doing good and who have been moral and have been, you know, loving truth to suffer because they're not aware of what's going to happen. Because when something strange happens, even if you're not the generator of that, you might be misaffected when you see it. And then your behavior might change and you might do some really dumb things. So my sort of message is also to warn people that, look, when these sort of revelations come to you, even if they're in the most intimate circumstances of your life, do not debar them. Do not fear them and let them happen, because it's a natural cleaning cycle that's taking place. There is dirt and there is toxicity and there is evil in the world. We're being shot at. There's all sorts of difficult, you know, there's all sorts of malign adversarial agencies, and those are from the most intimate level up to the state level. The light that is coming is going to shine that up, and it's going to start snipping the web. So that all of these, you know, pieces on the board, shall we say, are going to be tipped off and shown for who they are. Now, the individual who means well and is a moral individual will also be subject to a lot of this and might have a fear reaction. So my words are just to tell people what is happening, to let them know about it, and that they must not then respond in fear. They're meant to step aside and let it happen, because this is an important cycle that nature has. Nature is an incredible spring cleaner. It's like what we're going...
Well, when you say let it happen, do we have a choice?
You always have a choice. And, you know, what, it's like if a building is falling, don't try to prop it up. That's what I'm saying, is that this thing is a natural...
Get out of the way.
Or help it. If you can even get into a mode where you are so... you will it into existence. You will it into your life. Why not see what's behind the mask? We have been lied to by people. We have people that we think we love in our own intimate connections who are sucking our energy. We have that on the state level. We have a lot of buildup of toxicity. Don't blame the buildup of toxicity. That's a natural phenomena. You know, dust will gather. You know, as they say, rust will happen. Fruit will rot. It's a natural catabolic dynamic of the universe to have a catabolic entropy type of action. But then there is a cycle that comes in to take care of that, like to clean it up, a hygienic way. And this is what the planet Pluto's conjunction is. This is what the Maya we're talking about. It's what the end of the age of Pisces is all about, that there's a cleansing period. Civilizations are created, they rise, and then they fall. And at the time of the ending, now here's the most amazing thing. There's 12 signs of the zodiac. So this cycle of ending and closing happens 12 times. But the reason, George, why it's so important for us today is because Pisces, the age that we're in right now, is the last of the signs of the zodiac. So it's more specific. It's more intense. It's not just the ending of any old age, age of Taurus, age of Aries, what have you. It's the end of the age of the zodiac itself. So this
is
why.
Let me ask you this, though, Michael, and I want to see if we can rule this out. 2012, can you rule out that we're going to get hit by an asteroid during that period?
I am of the belief, I don't know what other guests will say, but I am not looking to any of that at all.
Okay. Can you rule out a polar shift? Can you rule out some major solar eruption that's going to wipe us out, gamma burst?
You cannot rule it out because, as I said, the connections between the microcosm and the macrocosm are connected. Man's consciousness is quite capable of bringing about anything conceivable in the theater of the outside world. I don't rule it out. But what I want to do is swing the balance over, you know, sort of sidelight, downplay the external phenomena, and make people realize that it's because of certain, it's the complexion of our consciousness, it's the temperament of our psyche that is causing it to happen. This is, you know, old stuff. I mean, Carl Jung, Sigmund Freud, they've all talked about this, but somehow we've got off the track of understanding this. The old shamanic traditions always spoke about it. The Bible speaks about it, that the microcosm and the macrocosm are connected. The Greeks said that a man's character made his fate. Carl Jung said that whatever you do not bring, you know, from within you, you do not resolve inside of you, becomes your fate outside, so you will get to resolve it. This is known metaphysical, philosophical, psychological fact. It's 101. However, it also works on the collective level. So when you're saying that it could come from an external source, of course it could, because we can will that to happen. We can subliminally will all kinds of things in so that we meet the beasts and we meet the demons and we meet the shadows that we ourselves are casting from our own mind. It's this psychological aspect that most interests me, but I certainly do not rule out that then it can manifest in wars, in the coming down of a new world order situation, of more draconian types of regulations, the loss of sovereignty. All of these idioms that I talk about in the DVD on 2012, we go into this and try to show and highlight the connections between consciousness, or shall we say, psychic energy and physical energy. The idea that psychic energy and physical energy are two different things is an illusion that we are taught from young. It doesn't exist. We're just taught that there's a disconnect. And so we have a bipolar mind that sees psychic energy and physical energy as two different things. They're not. They're intimately connected. Quantum science has proven that. And it's extremely important to realize that whatever happens at a particular junction like 2012, it is not some random miscellaneous thing that just happens to be out there, in the cosmos, and oh my goodness, look what's happening on the sundial and on the time. No, time is energy. It's connected to consciousness. And so this is where the triggers are. The triggers are in the human consciousness. And whether that consciousness is toxic, meaning immoral, or moral. Because there's a very, very important reason why the word sanity and the word sanitize are connected. In order to be sane, you have to be hygienic mentally. That means being moral. That means having a center. That means being sovereign. You cannot have social or political sovereignty unless you have inner spiritual moral sovereignty, and there's no way to put the cart before the horse there. And we're going to live in the age now of apocalypse in which we're going to, there's going to be a sort of a division of the sheep and the goats to see which people have this kind of thing prioritized. Who has their moral house in order? Who has their inner republic in order, you see? And then those people have the right to ask for it to be externally. But you can't have it externally if you don't have it within. And this simple law is going to be retaught to us in the next couple of years.
Michael, this is now Thursday in most time zones, and today is the day that a former French air traffic controller by the name of Eric Julien predicted on this program that part of this comet, 73P, that is breaking up, that today's the day, he says, a huge chunk is going to smash into the Atlantic Ocean and cause a tsunami so big it'll wipe out half of the eastern coast of the United States, for example. Well, I don't think it'll happen.
No,
but that's his prediction.
And he's not the only one. There's so many people who predicted all sorts of devastation, and almost any clairvoyant that you meet who's ever had any background in clairvoyancy will always tell you that at one time in their life they always thought the Eiffel Tower was going to, fall down and the mountains were going to erupt. It's a common, well-known idiom, and I know where it's rooted. It's rooted in the psychology of a lot of people who get into this kind of field. You see, we must not forget also that just because you may be clairvoyant or have certain intuitive abilities, it doesn't mean that you are also hygienic. You also have your own inner problems. You also have your own psychology to deal with. A man's psychology is the bedrock. It's the common denominator of everything you do. So science cannot be objective because the scientific person has an unconscious that is involved in that experiment. A psychic can have his predictions skewed because, remember, that person is not a machine. That person has an unconscious. He has his own drives and urges within. So this whole psychological component, which we've very carefully sidelighted and downplayed, that's wrong. We are subjective individuals, and our own psyche and our own complexion, the temperament of our own being, the mix between our intellectual and emotional selves, must be taken into consideration when we, in our work and in our predictions and in our scientific endeavors.
Hey, Michael, you have a new website out on numerology. I want to talk with you about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Sure is. By the way, thanks again for continuing to push our book, Worker in the Light, up the list on Amazon.com. The pre-orders are doing very well. The book doesn't come out until September 19th, but we're making arrangements to take part of those proceeds, personally, me, and give them to needy coast-to-coast listeners. We already have the list. Those of you who are still emailing me, at least for this go-round, for this book, we've got, believe me, more than I can handle. But we've got the list. But thank you, those of you who are ordering the book. Pre-orders on Amazon are doing very well. They are selling it, if you're still interested, at a steep discount. And they tell us they'll mail it exactly that week when they get the book on September 19th. If you're interested, Amazon.com, just search under Worker in the Light or my last name and just take it away. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Tesserian, our guest. Michael, tell us, what are you doing in the world of numerology all of a sudden?
Well, remember the last time we were talking about, I launched last year a great site on numerology, Timenosis?
Yes.
We've made, in the last couple of months, again, based on the overwhelming influence
response
from the people.
Yeah,
exactly. It's just been incredible. We've had a lot of input, and we've basically, it's the same site. We just upgraded it. We have like a 2.0 type of situation right now. And the brilliant thing that members and potential new members need to know is that now, when they sign up with us, they can actually have this personal time scope, this chart that's based on the numerology system that I work with, into their email box. It's actually connected to iCalendar, to Outlook, you know, to Google, so they can just download it. They don't have to visit our website anymore. It's more customized. It's easier to use. They can also update should they need to, and they can customize how they want to look this new calendar, this numerological calendar to look, so that, you know, for beginners maybe who are not totally familiar with the system, they would just want their predictions for the day, which is wonderful. That's what I get, actually.
Oh, that's great.
I've been working with the thing since I'm 9 years old, you know, 9 years old, and I prefer to get just my day. You know, I mean, you can have the month and the year. You just need to select those buttons. But the idea is that,
well, I'm like you, Mike. I just want to get through tomorrow.
Right.
That's it. You know, when I do that, then I'll worry about the next day.
And that's what we do. So every day, if you make that selection, then every day when you wake up, it'll greet you in your mailbox. And the beauty of why Timenosis is important is because of the Internet. I've taught this in mystery schools for years. I thought that two things were happening, and that is that I always felt kind of bad that, people had to come on to the mystery school and learn the whole thing from beginning to end, all of these things, astrology, tarot, whatever. And that this beautiful piece of numerology was kind of restricted to those full members. And I wanted a way to modulate it so that the world, the rest of the world, you know, could benefit. And it's just with the Internet, that time, I had to wait for the time of the Internet, basically, because there was no other way of doing it. There was no other way of modulating the numerological aspect of it. So now, if you're using Outlook, if you're using the email, you will have this chart pop right in there every morning, so you will know your intention, because this subject of numerology is vitally important. The whole universe, including your body, and the whole universe, it's the architecture of the human psyche, just like the architecture of the universe, is based on numbers. Science knows this. The Pythagoreans knew it, and the builders of the pyramid knew it. And the malign adversarial agencies that operate in this world are obsessed by number and know about time and the mysteries and the secrets of time. It's about time that we started to use these important things. I mean, people count on their fingers, don't they? You got 10 fingers, and the people have been counting on them for years. The idea is that, remember, we were just talking about the Maya. One thing that the Maya talked about in their prophetic work is that the date of birth of a human being is the most important set of numbers in their life, and that the key to their success and the key to their destiny is in those few numbers, those three numbers of the date of birth. And numerology, or the science of number, was the mystery of connecting to that success that's in a person's date of birth. The Maya knew it thousands of years ago, and the whole of the universe is based on these number symbolism. And metaphysical teachers, you know, like myself, have been teaching it and benefiting and using it personally. And it just was, how can we, okay, so you have your class members and they benefit it, but I always felt that this particular modality must be used and must be known by, you know, as many people in the world as possible. And now through this modality of the Internet, we have that chance. And the second thing is, you know, it's taken a long time because it's difficult to do this.
Oh,
you
sure.
Well, you see, I can't just go and hire anybody and a technical team to create such a database. You have to have somebody who's both a scientist, very familiar with Internet programming and all of the database programming, and as is also wholly committed and interested in the subject that we're talking about, in this case, numerology. And to find that team to work with has been also a lot of delay, because I find some fantastic scientists and people who could do it, but they're not conversant with the subject, don't use it themselves, and I preferred not to use kinds of people like that. So I had to wait till I could meet the right people who are expert scientists and expert programmers and knew the power of the Internet, and also were lovers of the subject of numerology. And last year we found these people, and who have been working overnight now. We've just made the upgrades, so I wanted to make sure that people know that when they come online now, it is connected to their email, and you can have that selected so that it comes in every morning there, and you'll have your prediction for the day, which is customized to you and vital for your empowerment, vital to use the power of number, for your overall success, both physically and spiritually.
What causes this to work?
Metaphysical science, quantum physics. This thing is not bogus. It is not something, the architecture of a man's life is based on numbers. He's born on a specific day, and you can never erase that. You can never change that. And in my system, what I did was I combined, as people in the mystery school knew, I've taught, is I combined the old subject of numerology, George, with astrology, which had never been done correctly before. There's a synchronization here, because we have the old Gregorian calendar, and we have this calendar that is just totally not right. The ancient metaphysical subjects go by the 12 signs of the zodiac, so somebody had to come along and marry these two together. Now, the beauty of the Time Gnosis site is that you don't need to know any of this. This is all back-end stuff. We're not asking people to come on like they do in the mystery school to take a long time to discover the mysteries of numerology. What we're talking about here is using the benefits of the subject, like you already said yourself, and not having to, learn the whole of the metaphysics of it. What's the point of learning the metaphysics of these subjects if it's not going to benefit you, So that's our job. The job is of the creator is to make it easy for others to benefit without necessarily, learning all of the nuts and bolts of it. And that's, again, what we've done. But, time is a phenomenon. It exists, and men and women are slaves of time. The beauty is that we can turn that reality around. We have choice, and through understanding the true nature of time and its connections to consciousness and understanding that it can be your best friend as opposed to your enemy, your life swivels and changes. I think the best way to explain it is that everyone in this world, everyone listening to the show has intention. They have passion and they have intention. They have a life vision. They have a vision of their life, and they have daily intention about the things they're going to do in the day or the year or the life. But see, that's like a river that has no banks. That's like a vine that has no bamboo to keep it straight. I think that everyone has the intention. But what happens if you don't have the channel for that intention, or you don't have the lens to focus it? Numerology is an ancient metaphysical science that allows you, if you know how to work with it right, to focus your intention and your passion and your will and your drive so that you can attain the goals that you set. The reason why people are unsuccessful, why they're not reaching the goals, and whatever those goals are, they work right across the board, physical, spiritual, mental, relational, whatever, business, you name it. The reason why there's a sort of people miss the target a lot is because they have all the intention in the world, but they have no focal point for it. The metaphysical arts are nothing more than that. They're modalities to help you focus your will and your intention. That's what the smart people know behind the thrones of power in this world. They're the ones using it on us. They're the ones telling you you're going to get up at, whatever hour and work for 9 hours to this moment in time. So we have a very soft...
or 12 hours.
Yeah, can you imagine? We have a very soft... The human race, unfortunately, is not using the power of time appropriately. This is a major reason for the lack of success and the lack of empowerment in this world. The masters, the hidden masters, are using it. They use sidereal time. They use astrology. They use these things for their empowerment. The idea that we're working on is that, we can turn that dynamic around and have ordinary people using some very powerful modules so that their own will and their own intention is not just going to fizzle out, and then they get jaded. Then people get jaded, nothing works for them, and they feel, they feel down, and they feel pessimistic instead of optimistic.
What is that website, Michael, the one on numerology, if people want to go to that and just start
set people up have on a pen, emails? If they have a pen, they can write down timegnosis.com, T-I-M-E, like time, all one word, gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. But if they can't write that down right now, then just go to my own website, michaeltesarian.com, and use the link there, and you'll go through, and you just sign up. And
of course,
then
you better spell your last name.
Oh, that's true. Tesarian, T-S-A-R-I-O-N, and the last N is Norman, like N for Norman. And if they sign up now, we also have uploaded to that site some audio clips. There's a little audio tour, so again, people can learn a little bit of the background if they so desire. But if they sign up, then they can customize their calendar, and it'll be there for you every morning now. And it's also set to universal time. It's also set to all the time zones of the world. So no matter where you are, you can have it accurately, come in through.
Tell me about the origins of the Oracle series that you produced. What is that?
Yeah, the DVDs. This has been a 2-year project that we've been doing. Again, only one of them was pre-planned. The one. Do you have them there?
I have them on my desk in Los Angeles. Remember, you were going to be on when I was in L.A., but you had to cancel. Well, I'm in St. Louis this week. I'll be back in L.A. next week, but your DVDs are sitting on my desk out there in L.A. I was looking at them, ready to look at them that night that you were going to be on. You got canceled, and I said, good, I'll look at them next week. And lo and behold, here I am in St. Louis. But
that's okay.
I'll see them when I get back.
I'm just glad they arrived. I didn't even know until you told me that they actually got there.
But yeah, they're there.
There's 6 programs, as you saw, 6 box sets. And only one of them, which was the subversive use of sacred symbolism in the media, was intentionally planned by me. This is one of the remarkable things, because the launch date was only a month ago, April 27th. It was the launch date publicly of the DVDs. They've taken about 2 years to create. But, you know, I was saying to a friend, we were talking about this since the release date, and I've had lots and lots of emails, and I've been actually telling people this, that none of these DVDs, except one, out of the six, only one was actually planned by me. And that was the subversive use of sacred symbolism in the media, which is something I've just been interested in since I was very young, in my teens. But every other one of them, the Atlantis one, the 2012, the whole shebang, those came about from people suggesting that I put my information down, you know, on video and DVD. People like Brian Hall of Conspiracy Con and Victoria Jack. In fact, I'm in the Bay Area now. We're going to have a Conspiracy Con coming up in a couple of days, 27th. Memorial Day will be a Conspiracy Con. And it was people like that who had really loved my work, you know, stuff on the Celtic origins.
Oh, sure.
And all the rest of it, who were kept on badgering me to say, you know, why don't you put this down on video? And we did. We did small videos. Most of those videos were me being filmed by others, filmed at conferences. And they're wonderful and everything. But, you know, George, it's like, you have all these fascinating subjects, but if you do the talks publicly and they're filmed publicly, they are inevitably edited for time and for content.
Yep.
And even though it's wonderful to have been filmed and to have these things out, and I sold these in the past, and then the audio quality starts sucking, you know, and you just don't like, you know, you just don't like to have everything so edited, because we need beginning and middle and end. We were talking about some
well,
of the
it changes the concept of what you're saying.
It does. And also, we are a select group. The people who listen to your show, for instance, you know, are not favorites of the people that they know. People look at us as kind of cranks, and they don't honor these subjects. And the people that do have to plow through a lot of resistance to be into this kind of subject matter. And therefore, that means that this information must be treated reverently, and it must have a beginning, middle, and end, because we are facing an onslaught of denial and rebuttal about these fascinating subjects based on history, based on, you know, all the controversial stuff that we deal with. So it's very important then to treat the information reverently, and that was what I wanted to do. And then along comes the digital kingdom, basically. So I had all my videos in front of me that we used to work with, and I thought, okay, you know, I'll redo these. And I hadn't even thought about DVD until people like Brian Hall and others were saying, and they were sort of supporting me to do that. And then I got the idea to do it, and then not edit it, not have it all chopped up into small parts, but to do some real encyclopedic work and create the Origins and Oracles series. So there's six in the series now, six shows, all different, but they, you know, have a theme.
So you're basically bringing people to your conferences almost as if they were sitting there in the audience.
That's what it is. That's basically what it is. I think that the person that I've had in my mind since the day that I got the idea, it was about 2 years ago that I really had to sit down and say, okay, this looks like it's going to have to begin. We're going to have to do this. We're going to have to build a studio. We're going to have to make it a reality. Because, of course, it's been based on, 25 years of research. But when you actually sit down and go, okay, we got to start doing this. We got to start physically creating this. Where's the team? Who's the cameraman? Where are the editors? When you start this process, so suddenly, I don't know, it must have been a right brain revelation. I've always been a real fan of Joseph Campbell. You remember the great American mythologist?
No.
Joseph Campbell, he worked with George Lucas on a lot of the work that George Lucas was putting together on the Star Wars project.
Okay, all right, but I wasn't that familiar with his name.
Right,
but
he
I
was
know,
a consultant.
I knew that Lucas worked with somebody on a regular basis.
That's
was
right.
It was him, okay.
That's right. Now, Joseph Campbell was one of the greatest American scholars into the field of symbolism and mythology, and I actually adore his work. I've always been inspired by it, and he used to run a program called Transformation of Myths Through Time, and also the mythic world. He did a series of six videos with Bill Moyers, which were based on, you know, mythology. He also wrote a book on the solar hero, the hero with a thousand faces. He's a very famous character, and he also was an advisor on some of the works of Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
Okay.
I adore his work. And so,
well, he's a behind-the-scenes guy, then.
Yeah, very much so. And he worked out of, I think it was Princeton or Cornell, I can't remember which. He was the mythological scholar there. And his shows had the biggest impact on me all through my life. And I'm sure many of the people listening tonight feel the same way. He was a tremendous disseminator of knowledge. And so when I started to get the idea of putting the DVDs together, it was his image that I was trying in a way to emulate. That was my sort of guiding light or guiding star. And I'm happy with how the Origins and Oracle series came out, because I believe that I did it. You know, I captured it. In my opinion, they're a success, because I was able to, you know, sort of model it on the work of Joseph Campbell. But again, as I say, if it hadn't been for the input of people, believers in me, and saying, you know, you must do these in a more extended way, and giving me the suggestions, you know, none of them would have been created. So I have a lot of people to thank. You know, two or three of the shows are actually dedicated to Jordan Maxwell for his work. There's one on astrotheology and one on the subversive use of sacred symbolism in the media, which are dedicated specifically to Jordan.
What a mind he has, huh?
Yeah, but it's other people on your show. You've had other guests, lots of friends, Richard Hoagland. You know, there's so many different. Yeah, these people believed in me, especially Brian Hall from Conspiracy Con. Brian Hall allowed me to talk on the subversive use of sacred symbolism, I think 2 years ago, at his Conspiracy Con, which is a subject that was a little bit off the wall. It wasn't necessarily something that you would normally talk about at one of those conferences. But when he understood that I wanted to talk about that subject because of the children and the youth, then he realized that this is a missing piece that we need to get into because of the psychic dictatorship that's in our midst, based on the psychic tyranny of advertisements and the subliminal, sick pornographic content, you see, that's diseasing our youth.
Good
and
point.
It's just, I can't even, this was something I've been studying for since I was 13. It was the only one of the DVDs that actually was pre-planned, that one day I knew I'm going to get some format where I can communicate this tremendous. Because, you know, all the great scriptures, including the Bible, talk about know thine enemy. And it's a good way of saying it is know thine enemy, but also know the weapons that they're using. And right now, one of the weapons that has been used for about 100 years now to really condition man and to use the force of persuasion and suggestion in a very negative way that's affecting all mankind, but specifically affecting the youth and affecting them negatively, is the subversive use of power symbols, symbols that used to be sacred to us, sacred to our religions, sacred to our, you know, nations and races, are being used. Powerful symbols from astrology, from the ancient world, are being incorporated into advertisements on billboards and on television and are pouring unadulteratedly into our minds, creating us.
Who knew that better than anybody? Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. Any dictator. This is a psychic dictatorship, and it's going on. And we need to know the enemy. But you see, it's no good to know that something is happening to you. It's no good to know about a conspiracy operating in the world if you don't know the reason why those people are perpetrating that conspiracy. You've got to get into their heads. You've got to say, what on earth would possess people to do this? And then what are the means that they employ to do it? That's what a creative way of rivalry is. We're not just to sit there and go, something is happening to us. We got to find out what it is that's happening, what the motive is behind it, and then what to do about it.
You know, in a weak way, Michael, corporations all have logos of their companies for marketing, for identification. But you're right. I think the higher power, as our friend Dr. Morgus would say, the higher order, they want us for another reason. Stay with us. Let's talk a little bit more when we come back. And also, we'll open up the phone lines next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, those are the numbers. So when we come right back, it'll be Michael Tazarian, your phone calls, and I've got a few things I still need to ask him. So we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Michael, what symbols are out there today that we should be aware of?
Oh, my goodness. That's what I've been cataloging since I was 13 years of age. You know something? I'm not even going to give any examples because I don't want to get into legal trouble, but what we need to really understand is that colors, rhythms, numbers, logos, 70% of the products that we buy in the grocery store, 70% of the products we have in our own refrigerators have names that don't mean anything in English. This is the same thing when we look at our cars, the enormous amount of astrological naming of cars and the symbolism that is employed. A lot of people have noticed. We have a situation in which ancient astrological symbols are being used by Madison Avenue that once perhaps were very sacred and had spiritual meanings attached, and now they're to sell you some pathetic toothpaste.
Okay, soap. I see where you're coming then. You're saying they're being used for not only control, but marketing and manipulation.
Sure. It started off with Vance Packard, you know, in the 1950s, was the first person to deal with this. And Brian Wilson Key picked up on the fact that it's also been used subliminally. And this is at 13 years of age I came across his work and started to notice this, and started to notice it in magazines and billboards. Now, of course, in the data space of the Internet, in video games, in Dungeons & Dragons, there's a proliferation of symbolism. Now, we live in a symbol-illiterate culture, so we're not able to decode these anti-spiritual messages that are being taught to us. The Illuminati, those who we call the Secret Masters, are talking to us constantly. The God Force is speaking to us constantly, but there's something that the kind of communication is not necessarily verbal. And so we're not able to decode then what the adversary is telling us and what the spiritual guides are telling us. This is the problem. So my work with children and communication was always to deal with symbolic literacy, symbolic, you know, understanding, the awakening of what we call the art of seeing. Because seeing, everybody does, but observation, nobody does.
Let me ask you a question, Michael. This is the one thing that has been bothering me since the tragedy of 9/11.
Yeah.
There are a lot of politicos who are now wearing, and I want to preface this by saying, I love this country, served in the Navy 9 years, and you know what? I would do whatever I had to do to protect its honor. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you a question, and it's the symbolism of these little lapel flag pins that I see most of our politicians wearing. Uh-huh. My question is I don't need a little lapel pin to prove my patriotism and love of the United States. I know I do, and people who know me know I do, and people I talk with know I do, and I trust it's vice versa.
Right.
I don't have to show the world that I have a little lapel pin. Now, is that a correct statement, or is it important to do that? Is it important to illustrate your love, your patriotism, by having one of these lapel pins? Well, my problem with all this is when I see some of these politicians do it, I think they're doing it for show, and that bothers me.
There's no question in my mind that you're right, 100%. This is just this jingoism. You know, these people are the enemies of America. Let's just cut to the quick. These individuals are funded by royal dynasties of Europe who themselves have used the power of symbols like the double-headed eagle, you know, the Masonic symbols we were talking about earlier, the pyramid with a missing eye, which is connected to the ancient Egyptian god Aton and Akhenaton. So symbols have been used to bring dissension to mankind, to bring them down into their lower energy, to confuse them. Colors are used like this. Rhythm, music is used like this. Numbers, the whole welter of right brain stuff that's out there that we're not consciously aware of is being used on us constantly. And it's also the basic idea is the pack. When you see these politicians, say, wearing this, you know, the similar logo, not only are these secret society logos, but it's the idea that, hey, we're cool, we're with the pack, you're the outsider. It's all this, you know, one against the many kind of dynamic, that if you're not wearing it, if you're not buying into this, if you're, you know, then you're against us.
Yes, and you're right. You're right. You're not a patriot if you don't do this.
There's a tremendous need in the collective ambiance to collectivize like this and to have outsiders. And there's a great deal of need inside most human beings, especially non-evolved human beings, in order to fit in. You know, there's a lot of when the man has lost his individual sovereignty, when a man has lost his psychic and individual sovereignty, and I see this with the children, then, of course, they're more likely to identify with those external groups. There's no kid is going to ever identify with some gang leader if they can identify with their parents. And if,
right.
and if the model presented by their parents and their peers and their brothers and sisters is a healthy model, then you don't go seeking for that same model, you see, outside. We have a people who want to disempower us through the media. They want to sell us extremely negative and pornographic and destructive and anti-spiritual stereotypes of motherhood and of fatherhood and of familyhood and of religionhood. And they often do it by posing that they're doing quite the opposite. But the memes and the messages that they're sending are extremely toxic. They enter into minds that don't have any symbolic filter. And then we see this deremption. We see kids being delinquent, moving towards crime and delinquency and jadedness. And even those kids who maybe don't go towards crimes and drugs, they're jaded. They're in a state of, you know, total pessimism. They have no interest in anything. Well, I'm here to tell them just, you know, because I actually taught this to children for 2 years, communication. I brought in 40 hours of commercials. And I said, hey, guys, you know what you're going to do today? You're going to watch commercials. And they went, hey, wait a minute. You know, everyone's telling us to turn the television off. Here's me. No. Turning the television off is no solution. Finding out what is coming over it and why it's coming over is empowerment. And I never saw more kids more alive ever. The other teachers in the school, the private school for kids, who had the wherewithal and the knowledge to teach kids this symbolic literacy, never saw more radical change in any of the classes in any of the years since the beginning of that school. When these kids were told, you are not broken, it is the society that is broken, it was almost like a massive exorcism had just taken place, George, where a demon had literally flown off through a window. When you tell kids there's nothing wrong with you, but you are being subjected to a psychic tyranny, and that is why your emotions are down, you feel confused, you have no sense of center, you're attracted to all the wrong things, both in diet and both in attitude, and to the wrong friends and to the wrong societies. There's a reason for this. It doesn't just happen. There is an actual barrage. There's a war going on, a war of symbolism. Jordan Maxwell has talked about this. I have been studying it since I was 13 years of age. But what I do is I go further than those critics of Madison Avenue. I go further than the critics of advertising. I mentioned there's many fantastic people out there who've been critiquing, you know, advertising. But man, we've got to go forward more than that, you know. And I'm grateful to, you know, Coast to Coast to let me have the opportunity to go further by saying that there is an occult agenda behind the manipulation of Madison Avenue, and it's not just rich power mongering corporations, psychopathic as they are, just wanting to make more money. That is not their concern, because the names of the products are not in English. These names come from ancient Hebrew, from Greek, from Latin, from the magical languages. The symbols of McDonald's, the symbols of Pepsi, the symbols of Coke. Oh, well, there I go.
There you go. You're getting too involved now. There you are.
Well, Mercedes, you know, Lexus, Nissan. You know, I've got an eight-hour DVD here that has been compiled over years. As I said, this was the only DVD that I wanted to plan to do, because I try to do it in book form. And this is a medium that just will not work in book form, and it will not even work if you try to do it on the web. It took the video age and the digital age so that people can see these corporate logos and symbols, even of any of the technical companies, and decode them. The idea is, you know, and again, I specify...
But they all can't be sinister, though, Michael.
Well, the ones that are created from Madison Avenue are sinister. Yes, there is an actual barrage, an all-out war on the human psyche. That is why a lot of...
You mean they want you to buy their product?
That's the ostensible concern. But remember, we're not talking about the merchant who's a genuine individual who wants to open a motel or sell a product like you and I. You know, that's normal. But unfortunately, we have an agency that these people go to that says, okay, let us handle that. Let us tell you what symbol and color and rhythm and music and logo, you see, was going to work. The merchant is completely ignorant. They only want to make money. They don't know about the whole other occult
agenda. I don't believe everything's an occult. I mean, if they're trying to make a buck, albeit some of it may be extreme in terms of their profit and their greed, but, you know, is there really anything wrong with trying to come up with a catchy picture or great marketing? You know, I was always told... that packaging was very important.
It is.
That's always a cult. No, that's greed to make more money.
No, but when you have the proliferation of billion-dollar, when you have corporations that are billions of dollars, you have an advertising corporation. You have corporations, and then you've got billion-dollar other corporations in advertising that merely monitor the use of the symbolism. Then you know something really weird is going on. When you have companies that are more expensive, right, and more well-funded than the actual corporations creating the products and the merchandise, then you know something's up. When you have Madison Avenue agencies hiring 50 psychologists on staff to go through every single second of footage of the commercials that they create, you know that there's something wrong. When you have got advertisements that are denigrating women by showing them with no heads, headless women, headless children, with children who are merely accessories, when you have the denigration of animals, when you have the denigration of the forests and, you know, our earth, when you have anti-spiritual messages, when you have fathers that are shown as dorks on most all commercials, and mothers who are sort of psychotic or pornographic, we have a culture of the most diseased, anti-natural, anti-spiritual messages coming across. This has been addressed before. It's not a new thing. We have Vance Packard, we have Gene Kilborn, we have Brian Wilson Key, we have Douglas Rushkoff. PBS has made whole hour-long shows on affluenza, but the one thing that they're missing is the occult agenda. They know something is wrong. They know it, but they cannot date it back. They don't have the occult metaphysical knowledge to say, where do these symbols come from? So why would they be being used?
Is it possible that some of these corporations don't even know what's going on within their own company?
The merchant does not know. You're quite correct. The merchant is absolutely only interested in one thing, selling his product, and he couldn't care less what symbol is used. He may not even like it. But he is going to a set of agencies that are highly skilled. They have ancient books. They know all about astrology. Let me just give you one example. We know, most people know that there's 12 signs of the zodiac out there. So the,
right.
So Merrill Lynch, for instance, will use the bull for Taurus because Taurus is related to money and to earth signs.
Well, and they talk about a bull market, that
right.
kind of thing,
so there's,
right?
There's, yeah, exactly. There's instances like that. Or TriStar will use the white horse and so on. A lot of these are astrological symbols.
Sure.
However, if it was, if they kept repeating the same symbols, and as not to say that they don't repeat, but they are clever enough not to repeat so often that somebody in the mainstream will catch on to what they're doing. In ancient astrology, in true astrology, in the true subject of astrology, it's known that there's 88 constellations up there. This is where the whole idea of the Chinese zodiac
right.
that has other animals comes in. But the true scholars of astrology know there's not 12 signs. That was just a nice homogenous setup. They homogenized the subject to make it easy for people. But there's actually, in the old occult books, you see, 88 constellations. Now, how come it is that the symbols of those constellations turn up on television in these corporate logos? It's because people who are working with an occult agenda, who are thoroughly skilled at knowing the libido of human beings, the mental capacity of human beings, the star signs, the alchemical, you know, advancement, the magnum opus, are drawing upon an ancient religious and spiritual archive, the Sacred Heart of Jesus, the Madonna, the winged horse, you know, the beacon, all of the different symbols that we deal with here have an occult agenda. It's not going to stop, but what we can do is we can decode it. When we discover that what these logos mean, is because I say to these kids who are dressed, like they're dressed from head to foot, like they're corporate logos. I go, look, I'm not telling you to stop wearing them. I'm not being a dictator here telling you turn off the TV and don't. Do it, but at least know what it means so that when you're wearing those shoes and when you're wearing those T-shirts and when you're wearing those logos, then you find out what it means. And you know something? I never in my life have seen more kids suddenly wake up to become critics of their society as opposed to cynics. And that is the key. This the children of the youth today have this sort of whatever attitude, like nothing matters anymore. It's because they're under enormous pressure to succeed in a place where the odds are against them. They're being barraged by psychic toxicity that is not even addressed by modern psychologists. I'll give you a couple of examples that are amazing in the research that I discovered. There was an accident in Newport Beach where a kid had drowned, and the lifeguard saved his life. And this was a kid, you know, the typical teen who never came out of his room, but, you know, had this swimming accident. And when he was dragged up on the beach, George, and he was coming out of the stupor of the unconscious,
right?
He was babbling commercials. Word perfect.
He was babbling commercials?
Word perfect. Some of the commercials were of his favorite team, and some others were of his favorite products. But the lifeguards, and this was recorded, this was noted, and it was noted that the person was literally babbling word for word perfect long series of commercials. Why was he doing that? Because his conscious mind was frozen for a moment until he
right.
was coming out of the state of unconscious.
Sure.
So what was being revealed was his unconscious self, and it was filled with these jingles and this nonsense of the commercials. In other words, his psyche was completely polluted. I'll give you another example. A couple of years ago, you may even remember, or some of your listeners may remember this, that there was a massive American-wide court case, a very high scandal that involved autistic children that were discovered to be accusing their own parents of sexually molesting them. Okay, PBS even did a big,
yes,
an
I remember
hour-long
that.
Thing on.
Sure.
Yeah. And they were saying, how can children who can't even really speak, who can barely move their hands, when they're interrogated by these doctors and medics, and then, of course, it became lawyers and judges and whatnot, they're telling that the most atrocious...
horrible stories.
The horrible stories that were done on their parents. Now, subsequently, when the full investigation took place, it was finally proven beyond all doubt that the parents were not involved. They actually proved this 100% because it fell apart. The actual theory fell apart that the mothers and fathers were not even present when some of these things were taking place. And then the show just left things hanging, and the whole law case was hanging as to say, okay, we realize that it was not legitimate, but then how could these autistic children be even knowing and saying these kinds of things? Well, let me tell you something. What do these kids do at these homes and even these outside homes where they're put while the parents are at work? They're sat down in chairs in front of television.
Their babysitter.
Yes.
Yep.
Right. Not just, and I'm not talking about, say, PBS or people sticking on good movies that they can watch during the day. I'm talking about regular commercial garbage TV. These poor people who already have a dysfunctional conscious mind and have no filters whatsoever are being subjected to this. And this proved it. And I believe that they left us hanging because they couldn't face the answer, that the pornographic stuff that was polluting these children's consciousness was coming in from the television and from the ambiance of commercialism that we have in this world, which I absolutely swear is not just to sell products. I can prove that. I've done it in the DVD, and it's been a subject that I have loved all my life. There are many other examples of this. But the delinquency, the eating disorders, the sense of pessimism, the utter delinquency, the penchant for crime, the sexual harassment, the gender dysphoria, the hatred that certain men have for women, the wrong messages that we're getting, the wrong messages that are sent to teenage girls about their body and their self-esteem. We have done a thorough 8-hour research into this.
But it's not just this country. They're all doing it now.
It's all over the world, but this is where the biggest barrage is, because America, remember, is the great country of the world, and it's very important for the hidden powers to make sure that this country...
I don't know. The English commercials are pretty risque.
In a different way. When you compare the European commercials, they're equally sinister, but it's just done in a different way. Each culture has its own... consciousness, its own particular...
Ours are a little more subliminal, I think.
Yes, they're more subliminal. They have a collective psyche. It's different in America than it is over there. This country is very young, and it is of a fresh group of people whose consciousness was trying to be fresh and trying to seek for certain ideals. Now, in symbolism, you know, I'm trying to make it so that when people drive down their boulevard the next time, they have a thorough education, not only of the cars and the symbols, but the colors that are being used against them, the architecture, the numbers, and the logos. We have to understand that certain...
Well, yeah, but some of it, Michael, you got to admit, is good marketing to sell products.
Sure it is. In fact, one of the reasons why I created this particular DVD is for marketers and is for those who are interested in forming and creating their own business. At the school where I taught children for those 2 years, a lot of those kids, when I asked how many of you guys want to work in movies and media and documentary making, you know, most of them put their hand up. But see, so this work has another side as well, a positive side. If it's good enough for Madison Avenue, and if it's good enough for Big Brother to know the power of symbols, it's good enough for us when we want to go and create our own websites, and when we want to create our own literature, and we want to put together our own businesses. It's vitally important that we use the symbols for the positive so that we can counter, you know, the other kind of barrage that's taking place. We learn what is being done so that we can use it more positively. Joel Bakan, in his wonderful book, The Corporation, and then, of course, they made a video about it, a television show, but he literally showed us that corporations are psychopathic. You cannot expect humanity or reason from a psychopath. And these corporations are basically psychopathic. They are trying to infect, basically, is the way I put it.
I tell you what the oil companies are doing. They're raising prices to such a high level that when they drop them a little bit, we think we're having a deal, don't we?
It's this. Remember we were talking about the slave with the bull?
Yep.
It used to be that the slave had a full bull, so he shut up. It doesn't mean he wasn't a slave. He's always been a slave.
That's right.
Now the bowl is getting less and less filled because Big Brother's saying, well, we got more slaves to fill, so your bowl...
And we think we're happy. Stay with us. Michael, got to take this break. We'll come back and take promised phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to be talking about exorcism, so get ready for that. Could be one of our scary Thursday nights, which will be a preview for the open lines that we're going to have Friday, so get ready for that as well. But when we come back, we'll take the promised questions from you with Michael Tesserian on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, to the phones we go, as promised, west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's Kevin in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George, real quick, you wanted some animal stories? We have a couple of grizzly
bears. Not tonight. We only got a little time with Michael Tesserian.
That's fine. Your guest is right on in so many ways, vibrationally, symbolically, and spiritually. Does he think that new light coming in is more of a kind of a weeding process?
It is. And once you've identified or diagnosed properly any ailment, you're halfway to the cure. When these children that I'm speaking of, and these are kids from all walks of life, this was in the Bay Area caller, when we were simply to point out what the psychic tyranny was, it was like you couldn't even imagine such a turn on. Suddenly these kids became like little detectives. And that was what they were doing at home. They were running home and telling their parents, I don't want to buy this anymore. Do not buy this product for me anymore. You know, they were influencing their parents and educating their parents about the symbolism that they were there when it was decoded. They did the decoding, and they came alive and started to realize that they can not only see what's wrong with society, but fix society, becoming little doctors, little agents themselves. And that cynicism that you see in so many teens right now turned to criticism, because there's nothing wrong with critical ability. It's an aspect of the human reason. And that's what we need to get back to. And if people are going to use symbols, then by all means use those cultural and ethnic and religious symbols that take you up and uplift the soul. It's a process of weeding exactly like you've described. But first you have to, that's what you do with one hand. To build up and use sacred symbols, you know, to empower you and to inspire you and to create passion in you. But with the other hand, you must also keep out the toxic, you know, the toxic sewage that some big corporation and some big brother and some massive inhuman psychotic advertising company believes is you know, good for you. And we now know. We know scientifically, we know demographically, we know statistically the damage that that stuff is doing. The difference with my work is that it goes into the occult side of it so that you know the history of these logos and symbols and what they originally mean. This rational approach is most important rather than the dictatorial approach that parents talk about where they try to censor the child, you see, and shut off the mind and turn off the television. It's no good. Deprivation is never going to be the answer. Education is the answer.
Next up, Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Michael from San Diego.
Hey, Michael.
Great program tonight, guys. There's a large group of people out here in San Diego who believe that a purification is just around the corner. And sure enough, last night we're watching this earthquake movie, 10.5, and San Diego was rocked by two earthquakes that were centered in Mexicali. And we believe that the shift of the poles is what's coming in 2012. We got Nostradamus. Edgar Cayce said that that's what's going to happen in the blink of an eye. And here's my question for Michael. Mm-hmm. Does he believe that UFOs are going to play a part possibly in the rapture before this happens?
Yes, but not in a good way. I'm a believer in what Jordan Maxwell has been talking about, that when the normal idioms of society and culture start breaking down, Michael, what happens is that Big Brother just doesn't sit there, you know, smoking their pipes. They need to also make use of that. They also come in and co-opt the discontent, the anxiety, and the cocktail of emotions that start leaking from people when the ladder is being pulled up. We have to notice this because, yes, a certain phenomena, sure, anything can happen. We've already had tsunamis even, you know, this year and so on. So, yeah, nature can do whatever it wants. But what we have to understand is that within the human domain, there are certain human reactions, fear, anxiety, whatever. And then we have another group who makes use of all of that, you see? And this is the dynamic that we need to be very aware of, is who is going to use what for what reason. So when there is a release of toxic, emotional, you know, negative energy, Big Brother uses that to come in and say, okay, now I will provide you then with security. I will provide you, but you just have to sign here for these draconian laws. And regarding the question that you've asked, which is extremely important, it talks about the collective hallucinogenics. The auto-programming or the auto-hypnosis of the mind, as you may know, as you probably do know if you're a listener to this show, most people that you would talk to about these subject matters just don't want to know. They're under a state of hypnosis and they don't realize it. So there's a collective hypnosis. And Jordan and I are thinking that, yes, there could be a situation in which there is projections in the sky, projections of angels or projections of demons or projections of certain crafts, and by God, it's easy to do. You can project this stuff from satellite, you know, very easily. I mean, they already project commercials from a ship off the coast.
So you're saying made up, not
made
real.
Up. Yeah.
All right.
Do you know that the coast of Dover, the famous white cliffs of Dover, are used as a projection screen for some advertising company?
I did not know that.
Yes, they're using it right now. And they've also got a project to beam advertisements onto the night sky and onto the surface of the moon. And there's nothing you can do about it, by the way. Hear me correctly. I want people to listen to this very carefully. There's already advertising agencies are so powerful that they're going to make the night sky a billboard. And there's probably nothing that most people can do about it. Now, the caller is talking about something that made me think of this, because there could be a War of the Worlds type situation in which it's always been considered an idea that threat, and threat from anywhere, threat from within, from without, from the Reds and the Communists and from Saddam Hussein and from God knows whoever, you know, it used to be Idi Amin and Adolf Hitler and the whole culture of people creating nemesis to scare us. And, of course, they're running out of those kinds of nemesis. So tomorrow it might be, yeah, they say it's extraterrestrial. Absolutely.
Oh, no, wait. Are you saying Adolf Hitler was not a true threat?
He was a definite threat, but who was behind him funding him? Let's ask that question.
Well, we know that. In a lot of corporations were behind funding
him.
But the point is, he was real and he needed to go.
That's what I mean. So the nemesis exists, but it's also the theory. The nemesis is crafted almost like a sculpture. He's made by design. Each nemesis has a certain button that, you know, they want to push. because the human being is a hard animal actually to control. I mean, they're dancing on their desks about how successful that control is, that's for sure. But in the end, the human can also restore himself. The human is an incredibly compensatory animal that can easily snap out of it if he's left to his own devices. So every generation or so, there has to be a new nemesis, a new fear, a new... We live in a very paranoid society. It's bird flu. No, it's people cracking into your email. No, it's this, it's that. Do you know that we live in a paranoid society? So unbelievable paranoia that we don't even notice it anymore. You know, and what we've got to understand is that the walls that we think are making us secure are also locking us in. This is what Big Brother's all about. It wants to help us wants to motivate us to create certain walls, but then those are the walls, like a suit of armor, that keeps us from a rapport with reality. So yeah, you're protected, but that's like a guy clunking down Main Street in full armor. He's protected, but he can't budge an inch, and if he falls over, he's dead. What good is security like that?
East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
My name is Akeem. I'm calling from East New York, and I want to say hello to you both, you George and Michael.
Hello there, sir.
How are you?
You know, I've been studying astrology for about 13 years. I wanted to know if Michael is aware of Grant Louis when he created the Grand Strategy of Living.
I'm not. The name sounds familiar, but it's not a paradigm I'm familiar with.
Okay. Now, in his books, he describes the cycles of Pluto that you've been describing, and
yep. That's
what caught my attention.
Right, the cycles, yes.
And it also helped me discover in the planetary makeup of each individual, whether it's George, yourself, or myself, or anyone that you may know, the hidden part of Pluto being active in one's life. In other words, the things that one individual refuses to let go that may be detrimental
to
success.
I love it. You're a man after my own heart. Exactly. It's the repressed aspects of consciousness. If we want to describe repression, which is what you're talking about, is the subjugation and the separation of the dark aspects of our own being that we don't want to look at. What we do is, as Freud said, we repress it. Now, repression is forgetting and then forgetting that you forgot. And all human beings do it. It's a very powerful technique of the mind. And, of course, we need it to a certain extent. But it's like anything that gets overworked. Repression is necessary. If we couldn't live in the world and be sane without repression. But what has happened in society is that repression has gone to the nth degree. It's way overcompensated. We're repressing aspects that we need to integrate into our being, you know, to be a whole person. But the government structures in the system does not want whole people. You know, what are we talking about? They've instituted schools and colleges and universities to make sure that nobody walking around is a whole person. So we have, you know, the listeners of this show are people who know this and want to realize that they want to integrate this stuff. Now, this cycle that you're talking about, that's a rhythm that's in nature, it's in plants, it's in the world, and there is this returning of the repressed content. And so Pluto moving in the heavens or crossing galactic center or doing any of these things is a sort of a signal. It's nothing more than a signal that now that unconscious repressed content is going to start moving forward. And for some, that's going to be intensely threatening. And for others, it's going to be extremely liberating. This is the key. And we have to realize that we want to be on the right side and welcome the integration of these aspects. It's the time has come. That's all it is. The time has come.
All right, let's go to our first time. Oh, by the way, I'm getting a lot of fast blasts, Michael, from people who want to know if you have information or DVDs for children.
Yes.
And okay, go ahead.
The subversive use of sacred symbolism came out of my teaching of children at the private school I talked about in Berkeley. I've done other classes. I've done private consultations. It's very much with the family and the children in mind because I am absolutely night and day up concerned about this psychic tyranny. I know my language is strong, but I have been working on this one from Belfast, from 13 years of age. My parents got sick and tired collecting the magazines that I would be, you know, with my magnifying glass looking at, wondering, what in the hell are you doing, buddy? You know, why are you collecting these magazines? And I couldn't explain it then. The idea that there is a psychic symbolic tyranny and the idea that it is part of our spiritual advancement, both culturally and racially and spiritually, to get back into understanding the power of these symbols. But as I said, there's a building up on one hand, and then there's the realizing of the pernicious, toxic, extreme version, the manipulation of our symbolic reservoir that we need to also be aware of, and the power of these symbols. And that comes from decoding the symbols that are in our data space and in our mind space. It's extremely important for the health of the world and for the health of children. So I have had people I've had people coming back. We only launched the DVDs a month ago, George, and already Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism is selling out because we have mothers and fathers coming back and buying four or five more than the one they bought to give it to their neighbors and their friends. I'm noticing that pattern. And that's why I'm bringing this up, is because this one is having the impact because it's something that all people can get into and discover what is going on here. We've spent about 8 hours decoding the symbols, the magical symbols, the corporate logos, the Masonic Illuminati connections behind them, and exactly how and why, you know, what's basically happening, how these symbols are being maliciously used. We're talking about the negative.
Let me ask you this, Michael. Let's assume there's a corporation out there wants to make money, marketing itself, but it has this kind of logo, the one you're talking about, that, you know, deals with the Illuminati, maybe the occult. What's its purpose? What's it going to be able to accomplish?
It's communication. All symbols outside of us trigger racial memories within us. No symbol is negative or evil in itself. Let's get that clear.
Right. The swastika was not evil until Hitler made it evil.
Right. And now, when somebody sees the swastika, what is the first thing that they think of?
The Nazis.
Right. There's your answer. Now, just because the symbol is not consciously recognized, because it's so old we forget, we've lost our conscious memory of it, it does not mean that our subconscious forgets it. The subconscious mind, as people like Bruce Lipton and others have proven, is 99% of what we would call consciousness or superconsciousness. Our little ego consciousness is pathetically small when it comes to, you know, the elements of consciousness. So what these symbols outside, when they're put on a product, when they're put on a company's logo or whatever, they are not necessarily referring to our conscious mind. They're bypassing the conscious mind, and they're going into the death instincts. They're appealing to limbic urges. They're appealing, say, for instance, let's have a very concrete example. They're dealing with man's ancestral hatred towards women. Over years, men develop, or in the consciousness of the masculine, there is a Thanatos instinct that Freud talked about, and a sort of a drive that hates women. Let's just put it that way. Certain symbols, certain logos, certain advertisements play upon that. They play upon man's desire for death and for morbidity and for necrophobia and necrophilia.
Any guy who hates a woman ought to be locked up, for crying out loud.
And they do the same thing to women. So then when you have these serial killers being arrested, and then after they've gone through some psychotherapy, and they're the first people to tell you, you know, I heard voices in my head. I felt that I was being possessed.
Yeah.
I watch a lot of TV and I'm addicted to certain kinds of videos. You know, we better start taking them seriously. Some of them are saying it just to get off the hook, and others are saying it legitimately. They have voices in their head. They are being influenced. But because we are symbol illiterate and psychologically immature, we do not understand emotional intelligence. We do not understand how our emotions and our psyche is being played upon like a game. These individuals know the right buttons to push because we have an ancestral reservoir that connects to ancient symbols, both Christian and other. And these names, these logos, these symbols, they trigger us, and then we react. It's like this. If somebody is advertising a light beer, okay, we won't mention any companies, but we'll just talk about the phenomenon of a thing called light beer. How come it is that they're using the word light, L-I-G-H-T? When you see the model drinking the beer, you also see them drinking in light. So the idea is that you're not drinking the beer. You're being sold an idea that this beer is spiritual. It is haloed in light, because light is a weapon that's being constantly used on us in our cities and from the television. And that you are now imbibing light and all that light symbolizes.
Well, don't you think it's primarily because they want you to think it's light in calories?
No, not at all. The symbolism shows you itself.
No,
once you know how to
Michael, I worked in advertising for 3 years, many years ago, and I worked on a campaign for a light beer, mm-hmm. and at no point did anybody ever bring up anything spiritual other than caloric.
The symbolism that is being used is spiritual, whether anybody brings it up or not. When you're using the symbolism, you are all automatically using a sacred archive that has a tremendous negative effect when it is put on a material product that has no benefit to your spiritual development. The symbolism is not negative, but when you apply or conjoin that symbolism with a mere physical product that you have to pay for and which impoverishes you and which may make you addicted and may take away your sovereignty and may make you lose your center, as is pandemic in this world, it is then that we have a situation that is toxic. The symbolism is not toxic in itself. But when you see models haloed in light, what does the halo of light represent? It's a spiritual archetype. It's a spiritual message. What on earth is it doing in a beer commercial? So we have to see, this is the thing that I'm trying to communicate to people, is we need to become symbol literate again. Otherwise, this stuff just sounds like off-the-wall controversy. This is, unfortunately, the learning curve that people need to understand, that these symbols are used as a weapon. Masonic organizations, Illuminati organizations, primarily use symbolism as a means of attack. You only have to look at the dollar bill for that.
Skeptics Corner Show one day, you and somebody from Madison Avenue. We throw you in the cage and one of you comes out. Would
you
do it?
We've already done it, George. I've had such people in my classes. When I talk
I mean on the show, here.
Definitely will do it. But see, you know why they will not do it? I'll tell you, they won't do it because they are desperately wanting to keep this stuff hidden.
May be right. I may not be able to get somebody to do
it. I've already tried it. I've already tried to be on panels. We launched it when we did the teaching in the college. I've gone on internet to do it. Nobody brings it up because this occult side of things is most hidden. And even the great activists within the world who have exposed the affluenza, the whole idea of the cult of anxiety and how advertisements that generate anxiety in people and all the rest of it, and who do know about the pernicious aspects of it, the one thing that they lack is the occult side of it. They're not conscious of exactly what it does. They're saying that this thing is poisonous, but they don't point out enough of the nature of the mind of the human being, what is being triggered that causes a man or a woman then to motivate to do the certain things. They're playing on our sense of identification. A cigarette company or a beer company or any company is playing on identification. Down through the centuries, man has always had one thing very important to him, and that is loyalty. Loyalty to his tribe, loyalty to his friends, and loyalty to his people. So loyalty, as we know, is a very important human trait. Now.
That's the clock, Michael. Got to go.
Okay. We're done. Anyway, Michael, it's a delight to always be on, George.
Always good.
Can
I get
my
agree with everything.
Out?
Sure, real quickly.
Okay. The number to contact me is 650-223-3304. It's michaeltessarian.com.
And just go to Michael's website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. My one apology to our first-time caller, Darren, out there from Iowa. You've been on hold for an hour. God knows how long you've been trying to call the show. I'm sorry we didn't get to you. For Dan Galante, Nikki Imbrunoni, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.